Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
I'm going to Radio Free Kansas.
Kansas.
Let's talk about
Radio Free Kansas out of North Jefferson County, Kansas.
Common side effects include heart failure, persistent fever, bruising, bleeding, lymphoma, nervous system, and blood disorders.
The message is now part of and registered in your subconscious mind. Every time you say, see, hear, or think,
Radio Free Kansas.
That's your key phrase. It will trigger the entire message without you being aware of it.
Oh man, that is just wrong.
If you wish to survive, you need to cultivate a strong mental attitude.
It's a fool looks for logic in the chambers of the human heart.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. A unilateral ceasefire took effect today in Colombia as members of the country's oldest rebel group met with government representatives. Shannon Young has details.
As part of peace talks with the government, Colombia's FARC rebels implemented a two-month-long unilateral ceasefire at midnight. The two sides are meeting behind closed doors until next Wednesday. The FARC has promised to halt all attacks on military and security forces through January 20th. Colombia's government has stated it will not consider a ceasefire until an agreement is reached. Negotiators from both sides are in Havana this week to discuss agrarian development. The issue of land is at the root of the decades-long armed conflict in Colombia and is the first item on a five-point agenda for the peace talks. It may also be one of the most difficult points on which to reach an agreement. In a press conference last month in Norway, the FARC negotiating team strongly criticized the Colombian government's economic development model with respect to land use, a model government negotiators say is not on the table for discussion. Shannon Young, FSRN.
Two of Argentina's biggest labor unions called a national strike today, demanding an increased minimum wage, higher retirement benefits, lower taxes, and more protection for workers injured on the job. Alicia Neal reports from Buenos Aires.
The streets of Buenos Aires are quiet. Banks are closed, no commercial flights are taking off, and since truck drivers are striking, no trash will be picked up, no ATMs will be refilled, and no gas or newspapers will be delivered today. Julio Macera, the press secretary for the Confederation of Argentine Workers, says he and other union members spent the morning blocking 160 freeways, streets, and bridges throughout the country.
We're asking for a minimum wage, retirement payments, and unemployment benefits that allow people to cover the basic cost of living.
Macera considers the strike a success because of widespread participation, though it remains to be seen if the government will give in to the union's demands. If the government refuses to raise minimum wage, Macera says his union will plan another action, such as a protest, in December. Alicia O'Neill, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
Rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo took over a strategic city in North Kivu province today and occupied the airport. The streets of the provincial capital, Goma, were quiet this afternoon as members of the Rwanda-backed M23 movement moved through the city unchallenged by either government forces or UN troops. Yesterday, widespread panic preceded a mass exodus of the city center and of surrounding camps. UN Radio's Patrick Maigwa reports.
UN aid agencies say the fighting has complicated humanitarian operations as aid workers have also been targeted. The fighting has displaced up to 60,000 people who are living at Kanyaruchinya IDP camp, some 10 kilometers from Goma. Adrian Edwards is from the UN refugee agency UNHCR.
Humanitarian activities are at this moment in many instances suspended because of the security situation. Since the beginning of the year, renewed conflict in these two regions has exacerbated an already dire humanitarian situation and uprooted close to 650,000 people.
The United Nations estimates that there are over 1.6 million internally displaced persons in eastern DR Congo as a result of fighting between the National Army and rebel groups in the region. Patrick Maigwa, United Nations Radio, Geneva.
Security forces unleashed violence on residents in a Kenyan town near the Somali border for the second day in a row. At least one person is dead, nearly 50 others injured. John Bukali reports.
The army crackdown in Garissa came after three soldiers were shot and killed by unknown gunmen yesterday, but security forces met fierce resistance from local residents. Several businesses were looted and a market burnt down. One local school official says that students were shot while in class. Mohamed Shidie, a local member of parliament, called on government to halt the military operation.
We want our people to be left in peace. We know the issues that are happening in Somalia. We are all concerned. We are not supporting Al-Shabaab. We are citizens of this country. It's like a tribal war. Any Somali is being beaten left, right and center. We are saying this must stop.
Garissa, a town bordering Somalia, has experienced several Al-Shabaab attacks in recent months. This is the first time the military has been called in, leading to the backlash from several Kenyan-Somali leaders who see the military's involvement as both unconstitutional and an undue use of force. John Bokali, FSRN, Nairobi.
The Canadian province of Nova Scotia added gender identity and expression to the list of grounds on which citizens are legally protected from discrimination today. The move comes on International Transgender Day of Remembrance. Events and vigils are scheduled around the U.S. and around the globe. According to the Trans Murder Monitoring Project, more than 250 people were killed in the past 12 months because of their gender identity or perceived identity. Information on vigils is at transgenderdor.com. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Manitou Vets Peace Action and Encuentra 5 sponsored an event called The Elections and the Unpeople. It was a left perspective and analyst on the recent elections with featured speakers Noam Chomsky, Vijay Prashad, and Samantha Christensen. The structure of the program was that each speaker first gave a brief talk about their impressions of the elections. They then had a panel discussion amongst themselves about their comments with questions added from the moderator. Then finally it was open to questions from the audience. The event took place at the Old South Church in Boston and was recorded by your radio host, Chuck Rosina, for WMBR and Radio for All.
That's right, folks. Coming up later tonight, excerpt. Here's an excerpt, a preview. Now, we'll be airing this in its entirety on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday. I haven't decided yet, but here's a teaser.
Democracies in a number of ways. One way is it has never barely had class-based parties. It's had sectional parties. And that starts right after the Civil War. The slogan was, you vote where you shoot. You know, so people who were on one side voted one way. That was democratic in those days. The people on the other side voted the other way. It was Republican. Now, it's not 100%. So in the North, the Catholic working class voted Democratic, but they didn't have much influence on the Democratic Party. In fact, probably none. They were in the kind of Tammany-type situations. The Nixon's Southern Strategy, so-called, the names changed. So the old polling results, the public attitudes, there's a lot of evidence that the racism is deep, and it's based on fear. Fear which is sometimes articulated that they're taking our country away from us. They being, you know who, we, the whites, especially the white Protestants, we're losing our country. We're becoming a minority. And people know that, and they're terrified. It shows up, the hatred of Obama goes way beyond any rational explanation. It's amazing when you look at it. So half of Republicans think that he intends to impose Islamic Sharia law not on the United States, but on the entire world. About 25% of Republicans think he might be Antichrist. 40% of Americans, all Americans, think he wasn't born in the United States. Now, that means practically all Republicans think that, yeah. Well, you know, these are divides that raise very serious problems.
The lunatics, like rats, scurrying across the floor in panic when the lights are turned up. For 40 years, they have assumed that the cultural world of the United States is to their advantage. Hatred of the outsider and of women distinguished their social view. Theirs is the rhetoric of freedom and liberty papering over very lightly a politics of suffocation. The main word was no. No to this, no to that. No to a woman's right to dignity, no to the unfurling of the full personality of the outsider. No to the social wage, public transport, public schools, public health care, public welfare, and of course, no to getting high.
I realize that lesbianism is not only a feminist issue, but it's the bottom line. It is what keeps women in their place by fear. So if you can't stand being called a lesbian or thought of as a lesbian, you're never going to be free.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Nigeria and Uganda weigh heavy anti-gay laws. Uruguay and France argue marriage equality and the legendary exploits of Ivy's League. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending November 17, 2012. Nigeria's National Assembly approved legislation this week that would throw LGBT people in jail just for being out, whether or not they had engaged in same-gender sex. It also imprisons anyone who fails to report homosexuals they know to the police. The heavy-handed measure passed in Nigeria's Senate last year. The West African nation already makes same-gender sex illegal, but the new legislation punishes a gay or lesbian couple with up to 14 years in prison for trying to get married, or just for living together. It also sends anyone who attempts to conduct a marriage ceremony for a same-gender couple to jail for up to 10 years. Even wedding guests could be imprisoned. Under the new law, a same-gender couple caught kissing or just holding hands in public would face 10-year sentences. The bill is now being reviewed on a clause-by-clause basis, although there does not seem to be a timetable for that process. It will eventually return for a final vote in Parliament before being sent to President Goodluck Jonathan for his signature. Observers say he's likely to sign it, although international online campaigns are urging him to veto it. Jonathan is also being pressured to reject the bill by several Western governments. Lawmakers could still override a veto. Nigeria's LGBT advocacy group, Initiative for Equal Rights, said lawmakers are trying to score cheap political points because no one has called for marriage equality in the highly religious country, which is primarily Muslim in the north and predominantly Christian in the south. The rights group also warned that passage of the new legislation would encourage more violent assaults against LGBT people.
Uganda is pressing ahead with its own draconian legislation, condemned around the world as the Kill the Gays Bill because, among many harsh provisions, it imposes the death penalty for what it calls aggravated homosexuality. Rebecca Kadaga, the Speaker of Uganda's Parliament, renewed her vows this week to push the measure through the legislature before the end of the year, telling the Associated Press that her people are demanding it. Private consensual adult gay sex is already illegal in Uganda, but cure-peddling anti-gay U.S. evangelical Christians have made several visits to the East African country in recent years, and an MP with close ties to them said his anti-homosexuality bill was needed to protect Uganda's poor children from being recruited into the lifestyle by wealthy Western homosexuals. While the bill does appear to be popular in Uganda, it also has attracted widespread criticism abroad. Some European countries have threatened to cut aid to both Uganda and Nigeria if their respective bills become law.
But lawmakers in Uruguay began debating 29 separate articles in a marriage equality bill this week. The South American country established civil unions for gay and lesbian couples in 2007, but the new legislation gives them all the rights and responsibilities of marriage, including adoption. Despite strong opposition from the Roman Catholic Church, the measure has the support of the ruling Broad Front Party. It's sponsored by the country's leading LGBT rights group, Colectivo Ovejas Negras, or Black Sheep Collective. Argentina became South America's first country to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples in 2010.
The French cabinet has formally approved a marriage equality bill. President François Hollande made it a cornerstone of his campaign last year, but increasingly vocal opposition from right-wing politicians and conservative religious groups, most notably the Roman Catholic Church, may be eroding what has been majority public support for the measure. Hollande has called the proposal progress for all of society. His Socialist Party has a majority in both houses of parliament, so the bill is still expected to pass sometime early next year.
Spain's Constitutional Court, its highest court, upheld that country's marriage equality law last week. Justices voted 8-3 to dismiss the appeal originally filed by the conservative Popular Party after Spain's parliament passed the marriage equality law when it was under socialist control in 2005. Popular Party deputies contended that the Spanish Constitution defines marriage exclusively as the union of a man and a woman. They regained power late last year after the country floundered economically. More than 22,000 civil marriages of same-gender couples have already been celebrated in Spain.
But Slovakia's parliament overwhelmingly rejected a proposal to recognize same-gender partnerships. The conservative ruling government and right-wing parties accused the measure's sponsors, from the opposition Freedom and Solidarity Party, of blasphemy and charged that its passage would undermine family values. Slovakia's center-right government created a committee in October to study LGBT issues, a move that in itself was sharply criticized by the Christian Democrats and the country's Conference of Bishops.
Elsewhere, the U.S. Supreme Court has pushed back the date it plans to consider cases involving California's marriage equality banning Proposition 8 and DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, which denies federal recognition and benefits to legally married same-gender couples. The High Court had originally said it would vote on whether or not to hear one or more of those cases during its conference on November 20th, with an announcement on November 26th after the Thanksgiving holiday. According to a press release this week from the American Foundation for Equal Rights, which spearheaded the legal challenge to Proposition 8, justices will now consider those cases during their conference on November 30th, with an announcement due on December 3rd. The decision to hear a case requires the votes of at least 4 of the 9 justices.
The counting has continued in a few locales since the November 6th U.S. elections. In a closely contested race that was not settled until 6 days later, Democratic former Arizona State Senator Kyrsten Sinema was elected to represent a Phoenix area district in the U.S. House of Representatives. She becomes the first out bisexual member of Congress. At least 5 out gay or lesbian Democrats also won House seats, and Wisconsin's Tammy Baldwin became the first openly gay person elected to the U.S. Senate.
Seattle area Democrat Ed Murray was chosen by his peers this week to be majority leader of the Washington State Senate. He'll be only the second out state Senate leader in U.S. history. The pioneering Alan Speer led the Minnesota State Senate from 1992 to 2000. 4 out legislators will lead their respective lower houses, Speaker John Perez in the California Assembly, and House Speakers Gordon Fox in Rhode Island, Mark Ferrandino in Colorado, and Tina Kotek in Oregon.
Newly reelected President Barack Obama this week nominated William Thomas to a judgeship on the U.S. Court for the Southern District of Florida. If he's confirmed to the lifetime position, Thomas would become the first openly gay African-American man on a federal court. African-American lesbian Deborah Batts became the nation's first out federal judge overall when she was appointed by President Bill Clinton in 1994 to serve as a federal judge on the Southern District Court of New York. Thomas joins 2 previously announced out judicial nominees, Pamela Kimai Chen and Michael McShane. Each awaits confirmation by the Senate, which has already confirmed 3 other openly gay or lesbian judges nominated by the president. One other nomination was withdrawn.
In other news, the American Civil Liberties Union filed suit this week against a Utah school district for removing a picture book featuring a family headed by 2 lesbian mothers from the shelves of its elementary school libraries. According to the Salt Lake Tribune, students in the Davis School District can only read the book In Our Mother's House by Patricia Polacco if they have a signed permission slip from their parents. Polacco is an award-winning author and illustrator of several other books for young children. Tina Weber, a mother of three in Davis schools and the only named plaintiff in the class action lawsuit against the district, told the Tribune that, "I don't believe it is for anybody else to tell me how to raise my family." She described In Our Mother's House as just a sweet story about a mixed family that learns to love each other. A spokesman for the school district said it was still reviewing the specifics of the lawsuit.
Meanwhile, a school district in Austin, Texas, canceled 10 scheduled performances of And Then Came Tango, a play based on the two male penguins at New York's Central Park Zoo, who made international headlines when they adopted an abandoned egg and raised the chick together. The district called the play inappropriate for school-age children. Playwright Emily Freeman, a graduate student at the University of Texas, said the play is simply about different families, including a young girl and her single mom, a zookeeper and the animals he tends, and two male penguins and their adopted egg. As these family structures are threatened in the play, we learn the power of voicing your opinions and standing up for your beliefs, no matter who you are. A spokesman for the conservative group Texas Values supports the school district. Jonathan Sains told the Austin American Statesman that the play tries to push and promote a different marriage definition, which leads students to ask questions about it and leads to the discussion of sex.
But finally, another pair of gay penguins, this time in Denmark, have become the latest proud adoptive parents of an orphan chick. It's believed to be the first time two male king penguins living in captivity have become dads together. Keepers at the Orensen Zoo first tested the penguin pair's parenting skills with a ball and then tried giving them the abandoned egg. The chick hatched last month, and zoologist Nina Christensen told the Toronto Star that their family behavior is the same as if the parents were male and female. Same-gender penguin pairs have also been given abandoned eggs to hatch and nurture in Spain, Germany, and China.
That's News Wrap for the week ending November 17th, 2012. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and produced by Steve Pride.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep This Way Out on the air at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
Just what makes a lesbian legend? Maybe it's matching cudgels with the woman who smashed the feminine mystique. This Way Out correspondent Abby D sat down with the one person who fits that description.
To legendary activist and artist Ivy Bettini, feminism and lesbian rights go hand in hand, an opinion not shared by many feminists in the 1960s, including one Betty Friedan.
Oh, yeah. I mean, she wanted me dead. I mean,
were you the lesbian that she was targeting? Was it you, or were there a few others?
Well, there probably were a few others, but I was the first thorn in this side in the New York chapter. In 1969, I did a panel. When the chapter formed and as we moved, I'd meet these lesbians, but they were all in the closet, deep in the closet, scared out of their minds. And I thought, well, that's not right. So I put a panel together, and there were 15 of us. I was a moderator. And the title of the panel was, Is Lesbianism a Feminist Issue? And the reaction, I mean, there were two lesbians on the panel, Barbara Love and Sidney Abbott, who wrote Sappho's Right on Woman. They were the only two lesbians on that panel. All the other women were straight. I was still married.
Did they know that you were a lesbian? Did you know you were a lesbian?
Well, I knew I was a lesbian. I didn't know how to get there.
Right. So you were still in that coming out to yourself.
Yeah.
Figuring out the logistics of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And not trying to hurt my family. Well, it didn't work. We used to have a meeting once a month. And I changed it to once a week. You can't have a movement once a month. You know, it's just it's insane.
That would be a crawl.
Yeah, right. And so one night was the program meeting, and I always advertised the program in the New York Times under Things to Do or whatever the heading was at the time. And normally we would get, you know, at the regular meeting, the members, maybe we'd get 40 members would come, and then we'd get maybe another 10 from outside. Mm-hmm. this one, where I advertised this lesbianism and feminist issue, that place was packed. There were over 300 people that showed up in the basement of that church. And I went, I think
I recall reading about this, that this was really a pivotal moment.
What happened after that was just amazing to me. The feedback that came back was that we were all lesbians on the panel. Because why would you want to talk about it? You know, why? And then Betty Friedan was furious. She was just, my ass was in a sling from that point on. And she was determined to get rid of me, and the elections were coming up. Normally we had 40 or 50 people at the elections. But at this election, there were like a couple hundred people showed up. And I had been warned by Barbara Love and Sidney Abbott. Barbara called me one day and said, Ivy, Friedan's out to get you. I have about 30 or 40 lesbians that will join, you know, save your back, because they still had time to join. It had to be 30 days ahead. And so I said, no, I don't want you to do that. I trust the membership. I've worked with them since the founding. I trust them. Well, the night of the election, paper members came. There had been this horrible telephone campaign that Friedan and her crew generated. Jackie Ceballos, who is the head of Veteran Feminists of America, she denies it, but Barbara said Jackie Ceballos is making these horrible phone calls about you, blah, 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 blah. So at that meeting, you could bullet vote. And so there were 15 of us on the steering committee and board. All of my people, when they realized what was happening, they all stepped down, so the only person they could vote for was me and a woman I'd never seen by the name of Vivian or Violet or Viola, I don't know. And she beat me by 7 votes because it was totally stacked.
I love the fact that you were a lesbian crusader even before you were really a lesbian completely.
Yeah, right. I did get elected to the board. Whoopee. And so I went to the first board meeting, and I read them the Riot Act and said, I cannot serve with you because you've known me for how many years? And now I'm this monster, so I'm out of here. So I resigned. And I remember I would go to work, and I would come home, and I would sit in this rocking chair I had in the corner of the room, and I would sit there. And she goes, what the hell happened? Is this issue so volatile, so heinous, that they would do this? That Friedan, who traveled by this time, she's traveling all over, would take the time to zero in on me. I realized that lesbianism is not only a feminist issue, but it's the bottom line. I mean, it is what keeps women in their place by fear. So if you can't stand being called a lesbian or thought of as a lesbian, you're never going to be free. Never, ever going to be free. You'll always be able to be controlled by this issue.
And I wonder if, conversely, that is the same is true for straight men. As long as you can weaken a man by calling him a faggot, that he is beholden to some kind of artificial sense of masculinity.
Yeah, that's why I say men should join the women's movement. Well, you know, I created this chart years ago, probably 68, because I did a lot of speaking. And so I created this chart, and I don't do it. I just put the headings up there, and then the audience actually yells out words. Like the first column is feminine, and I get them to yell out all the stereotype words about feminine. And I go, now, don't be shy. Nobody's going to hate you. You know, what are the, and there's this long list of dependent, mothers, nurture, blah, 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 sexy, you know, all these. And then the second column is masculine. And again, stereotype, butch, virile, strong, provider, father, you know, all the power words. Then I do gay man, and I get all the feminine words. And then I do masculine, and I get all the, how is it? It goes feminine, masculine, lesbian.
That one.
I forgot that And lesbian, I get all the masculine words. And I'm not creating
this. Which you think
this
would be a good thing.
Yeah, you know, they're creating it. You know, I talk about that you're actually looking at the germ of sexism.
This is Abby Dees, and I'm talking with legendary artist and activist Ivy Bettini.
You were talking about putting the words on a wall and what do people think about. So I'd like to do something a little similar to you.
Sure.
With you, not to you. And see.
And go ahead.
Just what comes to your mind when you think of these words? Dyke.
Strong woman. Very. Doesn't take any guff.
That word doesn't have any negative association for you?
No, I love the word.
AIDS.
Double-edged sword. One was horrible, and the other side of it created the large organizations. And although I think they have shut out the grassroots, if they could wake up and encourage the grassroots, it would be great. But they haven't done that. As far as the movement goes, as far as human beings go, it was not just a loss for our community, but it's a loss for humanity, because we are the creative people, and we will not be putting that out there. How many have died? I mean, how many died of AIDS that probably 50% would have contributed something meaningful to society, and we'll never have that chance.
Pride.
It has become a weak word because we have overused it. It's a great word, but over time, I think it's lost a lot of its meaning because we use it for everything. I wear pride T-shirts all the time. This says pride on the back. And, you know, I am a walking billboard. Pride has lost a lot of meaning for me because I think it's been softened because we use it just about everything.
Same-sex marriage.
I think it's wonderful for the people who want it. I personally think the assimilation is going to wipe out our community as a community because the assimilation is already going on. And we will be going back in the closet.
Really?
Yeah.
Why do you think that?
I don't think we will think of it as going back in the closet because the minority group does not move into the mainstream and then the mainstream becomes the minority group. It works the other way around. We move into the mainstream. We're going to be the mainstream. We will slowly let go of our, I think, our anger, of our commitment. And we will be the Joneses, except there'll be two women and two men.
It sounds like you're saying we'll lose our specialness.
Yes, I believe we will.
And what do you think is special about us?
Well, our creativity. It never ceases to amaze me. Our service to the world. I just think our brains wire differently. And I think we think differently. If you're part of the world that, you know, you've never felt discriminated against, you know, maybe you had to stand too long on a line, that pissed you off. But if you're a part of a group that has been on the outside and persecuted, I think your brain makes shifts for protection and strategies and how to get through your life. You know, which is a dangerous course. There are some people who choose to live with a woman or live with a man. But for the most part, we're born this way. I mean, if I could have avoided all the pain I had in my life with my family, my kids, the regrets I have on how they were hurt, do you think I would have done it? If I had a choice, I knew that was going to happen, do you think I would have done it? Probably not. We see things differently. You may look at that and say that's blue, and I look at it and say it's purple. It's just a different way of looking at life, and I think what we contribute moves society forward.
Do you think that's true for all minority groups, anyone that's on the outside looking in?
I think so.
What does the word tolerance mean to you?
I hate it. You know, I hate the word tolerance. I think it's an insult.
I think it keeps discrimination going because it's not an acceptance. Tolerance is not acceptance.
And are you looking for acceptance?
Yes and no. I'm not looking for acceptance that we lose ourselves. And that's what I think the marriage thing is going to eventually do. But I am looking for acceptance and safety for LGBT.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't understand me, I really don't give two hoots. But if you are going to go kill me, then I care.
Yeah.
I think, and even acceptance isn't even a good word. Acceptance means we've finally come to some understanding and from where we were, and okay, I accept it. So I don't know what
détente
word. Say, pardon?
Détente? I'm thinking of words. I'm thinking of,
yeah.
You know, because I don't necessarily want to accept people who have a belief system that's very contrary to my own. I mean, I don't want to be forced to accept them.
Right.
But I do expect a certain common respect. Maybe it's just respect. Does that seem like a good word?
It's something you have to do. It isn't automatic.
Yeah.
I did that painting. I am. That's what I want. I just want I am for everybody. No apologies, no excuses, just I'm alive and I am.
To learn more about Ivy Bettini, you can visit her website at ivybettini.com. That's ivybottini.com. This has been Abby Dees.
Follows Ivy Bettini's career into retirement. Wait, what retirement? Ivy's elder activism next time on This Way Out. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Tanya Kane Perry, Christopher Gall, and Abby Dees contributed program material. Thanks also to Steve Pride. Barbara Streisand performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is funded in part by grants from the Yavanna Foundation and the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, but we could not survive without the support of our listeners. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org for more information about us, photos included. You can also read News Wrap at our website and find links to our podcasts, our blog, and our Facebook fan page. Look for This Way Out on iTunes, follow TWO Radio on Twitter, email TWORadio@AOL.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038 USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on Q Nation FM, Cleveland, Ohio, Radio Phoenix, Phoenix, Arizona, 3BBB, Ballarat, Victoria, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
promise that I'll run away with you. I'll run away with you.
And now, Amanda Marcotte's fantastic RH Reality Cast.
Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's Reality Cast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinions, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
On this episode of Reality Cast, I'll be breaking down how pro-choicers won on Amendment 6 in Florida with Jessica Gonzalez-Rojas of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. Plus, two more segments on how reproductive rights played a role in the election and why conservatives have it all wrong. I don't even know what to say about this clip of Pat Robertson, except it's the best thing that's happened to me all week.
You're a sweet Christian girl. Lady.
Absolutely.
All right. Do you see anything in porn that attracts you at all?
No, Pat. These questions that you ask me, I'm like, really?
I'm trying to get your attitude.
No, that is not an issue for me. Thank you very much.
Well, it's boring, really.
Well, for some people...
All right, the thing that shocks me, shocks me. We always thought this was a male thing.
Yeah.
A boy thing,
yeah.
A guy thing.
Yeah.
But now it looks like 30% of women are involved in pornography.
Yeah.
And as an author, kind of a little housewifey type, who doesn't look like some glamour queen or something out of,
But you know what, Pat? This summer, the big book was Fifty Shades of... Was it Fifty Shades of Grey?
That's one I'm getting ready to introduce.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Let me let you talk. Fifty Shades of Grey. Yeah, everybody was reading the trilogy.
This woman...
The way that social conservatives can veer between believing women have no interest in sex and wanting to punish those who do show an interest is endlessly fascinating to me. I really wish they'd decide which one it is. The post-election analysis is coming to fruition, and the consensus among smart people seems to be that the extreme social conservatism that has become such a thing lately is one of the biggest factors in much of the Republican losses, along with the Obama campaign making a compelling argument for his economic program. There's the obvious cases, like the losses of Todd Akin and Richard Murdoch for misogynist comments about rape. But overall, the story is one of how there's only one group of people who really vote Republican anymore, and that's conservative white people who are swimming in resentment and fear at a changing world. Chris Hayes discussed this on his show when he noted how much diversity there is in the Obama coalition.
Think about it for a moment. What exactly do a Filipino nurse in Hartford, Connecticut, a Pakistani geologist in the oil fields of Texas, and a fifth-generation Chinese-American cop have in common? Same could be said for Latinos, of course, even African-Americans, heck, even, gasp, white people. That's because race is a social construction, not something out there in the world, but something we as a society create the rules, rhetoric, and identities for. And in the political process, nothing more assuredly creates firm political group identities than the experience of prejudice, contempt, marginalization, and condescension.
Hayes is talking mostly about the racial politics of the election, but I think it's worth tacking on to that understanding that most Americans really have concerns that are much broader than worrying about what their neighbors are getting up to in the sack and trying to find ways to punish it. Indeed, one thing that this diverse coalition doesn't share is the cultural context of conservative white America, whose imagining of the supposed good old days includes nostalgia for much stricter social controls on female sexuality and a general sense that women knew their place, which in turn makes it not surprising that they have different views on the issue, at least different priorities when it comes to voting. With that in mind, it seems like a bare minimum that a party that wants to be relevant in the 21st century would at least consider dropping the 19th century attitudes about sex and women's roles. With all that said, the reaction of the right-wing media this election was surely one of calm introspection, particularly on the issue of how out of step they are with how the electorate feels about reproductive health care, right? Okay, no. I won't even play with you on that. It was more along the lines of this.
We didn't just have poor women saying, I want free birth control. We had women who could actually afford birth control, suburban, college-educated women, turn out and say, I want free birth control. So this dependency politics is now in suburban bedrooms.
How do you account for 20 years of a gender gap?
It was goodies to even those demographics that they say Republicans should reach out to. That's how we
got them. How do you account for 20 years? Forget Obama. How do you account for 20 years of a gender gap with single women? There has to be a reason.
Well, they didn't traditionally vote for the longest time. Now he's motivated them to vote. And how did he get them out? Turns out they are one-issue votes.
That was Fox News' Andrea Tantaros accusing single female voters of being, to be blunt about it, greedy sluts trying to get laid on the taxpayer's dime. It's a strategy that's sure to win those voters over. Needless to say, a quick fact check. The policy that she's griping about is not free birth control, but simply extending insurance coverage that women are paying for themselves to cover contraception without a copay. It's no more free than any other kind of medical care your insurance covers. As for women who don't have insurance, it's not like contraception is some unimportant luxury item. Unintended pregnancy is a serious problem that we can easily reduce for this relatively inexpensive investment in contraception. Telling single women that they're a bunch of dumb sluts for voting for Obama was, by far, the preferred method of right-wing media trying to expand their appeal beyond angry white conservatives. Limbaugh was definitely at the front of that pack.
Women, let's
Let's start our own abortion industry. Let's go out and get the women's vote.
All whining about how stupid and mercenary female voters are, the time-honored way to get them to vote for you. But while Limbaugh is a reliable source of unintentional comedy revealing how little conservative pundits understand about normal people's sex lives, Gretchen Carlson may have bust out my favorite quote of all from the post-election coverage.
I also think that married women think less about abortion. And so even if you're pro-choice, you would tend to maybe vote more on the economy, because when you're married, you're just, abortion's not really, or contraception for that matter, is not maybe a huge part of your life.
I don't even know that I need to fact check this one, but let's just be clear. Married people actually have more sex on average than single people. Having someone you clearly like having sex with in your bed all the time is actually pretty conducive to getting it on. While it's important to make sure that everyone who wants to can get contraception, let's be clear. Married women definitely do not have a lesser need for access. The reason married women diverge from single women probably has as much to do with age and other demographic markers as anything else, not because getting married suddenly means your reproductive health care needs come to an end. I'd like to welcome Jessica Gonzalez-Rojas to the program. Jessica is the executive director of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health and played a big role in defeating Amendment 6 in Florida. She's here today to talk about that success and what it means for the future of abortion rights and access. Welcome to RealityCast, Jessica.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with what Amendment 6 was and what it was supposed to do. Can you kind of fill us in?
Sure. Well, Amendment 6 was an amendment that was added to the Florida ballot, which would have prohibited funding for abortion from the state. And it's really a repetitive, problematic ballot because the state already does not fund abortions with their money, but it would really just further instill the barriers to abortion access that already exist in the state.
How would it do that if the state already didn't pay for that, for abortion?
It would just really solidify that they could never make those changes, and it would threaten to take away health coverage from women and families that need it. And specifically, it would target people in the in public service, like teachers and firefighters, who may need the service for specific cases. So it was really a terrible bill, a ballot measure, and our goal was to get folks to defeat it.
And since it was an amendment to the Constitution, it was expected that it would be not too hard to defeat it, right? Because they needed 60% of the vote to win, right?
They needed 60% of the vote to win, but again, the wording of the amendment was really tricky, and we knew as a community we needed to do a lot of education around what it meant and how it would impact women and families.
So to kind of drive home how big a success you guys got, what was astounding is that up until the beginning of October, the opposition to the amendment was polling at 40%. So we had 40% of people that were going to vote against it, they told pollsters. But on election day, 55% of voters said no. So what happened? How did you get those numbers to go up so dramatically?
Well, I think from the behalf of Latina Institute, we worked with our base in Florida, which is called MILOLA, and it's a group of women that do work with the Latino community down in Florida. We partnered with a lot of organizations that were doing tremendous efforts in educating the community about the impact of the amendment, and there was a large No on 6 coalition led by Planned Parenthood. So we joined efforts, but we also ensured, because the Latino electorate in Florida, 17% of Latinos make up the electorate in Florida, so we knew it was important to specifically outreach and educate the Latino community. Latina Institute did a mailing of a bilingual mailing of 15,000 registered voters in the Florida Miami area, And we did education about the amendment and how it would harm women and families, how it would take away health care decisions from where they belong, which is with women and families, and instead put politicians in charge, and that it would really threaten the vital services that teachers, nurses, firefighters, other public servants need. So we really did the education. We encouraged people to make their voices heard. We did, in addition to the mailing, we did phone banking. We did events, public education events, and outreach with different members of the community, and also community members who have never voted before. And that was something really important for us to get, not just people to vote no, but people first to come out and vote, right, and get them engaged. So it was a really extensive process of outreach and education and partnerships and collaborations. But I think that this was a really effective campaign, and we were able to soundly defeat the amendment. And as you said, 55%, that was actually beyond our expectations. So we know that when women are informed, when families are informed, that they believe in protecting their rights.
So it's interesting to me because traditionally there's this divide with the American public, or there's always been understood to be one, where people support the right to abortion, but they don't necessarily think that it should be funded by mm-hmm. traditional health care forms like health insurance or federal funding like Medicaid or whatever. How did you get people to shift over to believing that not only should abortion be a right, but also that that one should have the access to the funding if you're insured? What arguments really did you find worked with people?
So I think what was important for us was really to come at the values, right? And for Latinos in particular, that we found through polling that Latinos support a women's right to make decisions without politicians interfering. So that was a really important value that that a lot of people support, and particularly the Latino community. When it comes to money and funding, one thing that we found was that Latinos don't think money should determine whether or not a person has access to abortion care. So that pulled really, really well, and that's a message that really resonated. And I think when people think about the discrimination that happens for people just because they don't have the resources to get the care they need, they felt that that was wrong. So that was a really important value that translated into the messaging and really helped bring out the vote on this issue.
So if I was to sort of kind of reframe it a little, there's the sort of women of color, feminists of color community has long been saying that reproductive justice is a more effective framework than reproductive rights. Do you feel that this was a good example of that?
Absolutely. I think, you know, we brought in a lot of different messages around access to healthcare overall, access to making personal decisions without politicians interfering, values of non-judgment. Latinos also poll highly that they felt that they shouldn't judge other women's decisions and other women who are not ready to become a parent. And that was a really important value as well. So you look more broadly at, you know, the different issues that women face around poverty, around systematic barriers, how does religion come into play? And we also found that although many Latinos are religious or identify as Catholic, that they don't believe that, you know, when it comes to abortion, that it should be legal, and they break from church hierarchy in terms of those sentiments. So, you know, those are all important issues to bring to the forefront, looking at race, looking at immigration status, reaching out to our community in ways that meet them where they're at, and ensuring that we have materials that are bilingual, that are culturally competent. So these are all important elements in thinking about how to advance a reproductive justice agenda.
So one of the things that's interesting is, I'm sure you've been watching the news a lot lately, and there's been a lot of discussion about Latino voters and moving them to the right. And there's this overriding assumption underpinning these discussions that says that Latinos are a socially conservative community. But the polling data that CNN collected after the election showed that Latino support from the voters that came out that day for abortion rights was higher than for the population.
Yes. 66% of Latino voters, and this is not just women, 64% of men, Latino men, and 67% of Latino women believe that abortion should remain legal. And that is actually higher than the general public or the general voting public, which was about 59%. So I think, again, part of the work that I'm trying to do is to really dispel these old myths that exist, that we're conservative and not pro-choice, and we are. And I think it is a nuanced conversation, but Latinos really support women's decision-making, would support a friend or family member in making those decisions, and, again, would disagree with church leaders around this issue.
So do you find that it's best, I think, then, to sort of approach this in, like, a personal way with voters?
Absolutely. You know, this work is very personal, and I think that's a really important framework to address it from, that everyone may have different feelings about the procedure themselves, but that they're willing to support a friend or family member, willing to advocate to ensure that it's safe and legal, again, disagree with their church on these issues. So it is really important to bring a more personal frame and understand that we're looking at individual women's circumstances, and not anyone can make judgment about what they're facing and why they make the decisions that they would need to make in terms of abortion access.
So my question then is, what does this mean going forward? I mean, you defeated this amendment, but there's a lot of work to be done doing things like sort of going forward and doing things are ideally like repealing the Hyde Amendment, which bans federal funding for abortion. Now, I know I'm thinking kind of big, but do you think that there's any lessons to be learned from this for these long-term goals?
Absolutely. I think this should embolden our leaders in Washington, right, that women can make their own decisions, that people support women's decision-making, that we need to stop denying Medicaid coverage for women who need abortion care, and that these growing this growing American electorate is behind that and that supports it. Latinos made up 10% of the electorate in this election, and again, in swing states like Colorado and Florida and Nevada, there was all these, you know, these are places where the Latino community is growing and is becoming very influential. So I think, again, we need to unravel old stereotypes that exist about our community and where we stand on reproductive justice, and put out a clarion call to our leaders that we need to address this issue and ensure that there's equity and access to abortion care for all women.
My guest today has been Jessica Gonzalez-Rojas, the Executive Director of the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. I recommend checking them out at latinainstitute.org. Thanks for coming to RealityCast, Jessica.
Thank you, Amanda.
I promise that the continued and extensive coverage of conservative inability to handle that the nation roundly rejected their backwards attitudes on sex and women's rights isn't just a matter of schadenfreude. I do think that this is a serious story that really captures the most basic obstacle to improved reproductive health outcomes in this country, an angry right-wing minority that simply can't let go of their obsessive fear and loathing of female sexuality. You know it's serious when they can't even let it go for a minute in order to soberly analyze the outcome of an election that had a million reasons for how it turned out, with voters being disgusted over the sex wars being just one. Mary Madeline's unfocused and overwhelming anger at Mitt Romney's loss is a really good example of how the right just doesn't seem capable of letting the sex thing go, even as they know it's bad news for them.
And because Romney is a gentleman.
Hold on, Mary. When you say the president doesn't have a mandate, he did win a majority of the popular vote, and he won decisively in the Electoral College, especially if he wins Florida. And we haven't made a formal projection yet on Florida, but he's slightly ahead in Florida. So why do you say he doesn't have a mandate?
What is his mandate? What is his issue mandate, Wolf? Free contraception?
I can't even convey to you how ridiculous her facial expressions were. She looked like she was sitting on a porcupine the entire time. Yelling free contraception as if that's the worst thing you've ever heard is simply not going to be a winning strategy when the vast majority of your audience, both liberal and conservative, believes both that contraception is a useful tool and that health insurance you pay for should cover your actual medical care. But as weird as all that was, Fox News guest Michael Graham was even weirder.
Absolutely. A president who ran on something, who said, here's my affirmative goal, other than raising taxes on millionaires and billionaires. It's the one thing he was clear on. If he had an affirmative goal, he could run on it. But he didn't run on an affirmative campaign. He ran on the Republicans are Satan incarnate, and if women vote for them, they're going to be forced into rape camps. And when that's your campaign, you can't be surprised when the people you ran against don't want to work with you.
This is part of a larger strategy of conservative media trying to insinuate that the president is illegitimate, claiming that winning a clear majority somehow doesn't mean you have a mandate, whatever that means. I don't want to be guilty of misrepresenting what is possibly comical hyperbole here, but Graham seems like he has no sense of humor whatsoever on this. The reality is that many Republican candidates did say terrible things about rape, and they did claim that you either can't get pregnant from it or that being forced to have a baby from rape is great for women. Obama didn't make that up. Indeed, Rachel Maddow did an excellent segment on her program explaining exactly how much conservative forces did this to themselves by insisting on running Republican candidates that are increasingly extremist in their anti-choice views.
Which is funny, because actual exit polling from the actual election yesterday shows that 59% of voters think that abortion should be legal in this country, which is the position of President Obama and a majority of Democratic candidates. And that is a 23-point advantage over the number of voters who think abortion should be illegal, which is the position of Mitt Romney and most Republican candidates. So on an issue where two-thirds of the electorate thinks you are wrong, the anti-abortion movement says the secret is that you should campaign more on what everybody thinks you're wrong about. The numbers get even worse for Republicans among Latinos. Yes, on this issue specifically, where less than a third of Latino voters say they agree with the dominant Republican position on this issue.
The cold, hard facts are this. After decades of screeching about the issue, anti-choicers haven't really been able to move the needle on the issue of reproductive rights. In some super right-wing districts, candidates who are extremists can win on this. But overall, Republicans win by dodging the issue and hoping moderate voters don't consider it a priority. But for that tactic to work, they have to seem also like they didn't consider it a priority. That's a hard sell when you have candidates making stomach-turning comments about rape, and a major issue that comes up over and over in your campaign is your opposition to simple solutions to reduce the abortion rate, such as mandatory contraception coverage and generous federal subsidies for contraception services for low-income women. That's when it becomes harder for ordinary voters to think that this isn't just about pandering to a minority of religious people who love fetuses, but instead a larger anti-sex agenda that is clearly on the front burner. And now for the wisdom of Wingnuts. Rush is wandering even further off the farm lately edition. Rush Limbaugh's show is an endless array of nonsense and paranoid fantasies, but this one was special even by his standards.
See, Daniel Craig, who plays James Bond in the new movie Skyfall, says there's no way there will ever be a gay James Bond. Yes, there will. Of course there will. We've got to see where we're headed here, folks. Of course there's going to be a gay James Bond. He's going to get married in a James Bond movie. It will happen.
I don't know what's weirder, his absolute assurance of this or his ridiculous identification with the James Bond character that allows him to act victimized by the mere idea of making the character gay. Rush, there is literally no character I think you could have less in common with than Agent 007.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for a weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.
American Crossroads. We are anonymous. We are watching you.
We know that you will attempt to rig the election of Mitt Romney to your favor. We will watch as your merry band of conspirators try to achieve this overthrow of the United States government. We see that you have taken steps to ensure that this election race is a close race, so you can step in and rig the numbers to elect your candidate, and then claim because it was a tight race that your candidate was able to narrowly squeak ahead and win. We want you to know that we are watching you, waiting for you to make the mistake of thinking you can rig this election to your favor. We want you to know that if we catch you, we will turn over all of this data to the appropriate officials in the hopes that you will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. We are watching and monitoring all of your servers. We are watching traffic on each of them for anything suspicious. You will not get away with any fraud without consequences. We are anonymous. We are a legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget. Expect us.
That appeared on YouTube 2 weeks prior to the November 6th election. And here's what Tom Hartman had to say after the election.
Why Roe failed to deliver Ohio on election day, what happened in Ohio this time around? And but what Bob Fitragus points out is that in the book Boss Roe, and thank you, Daniel, and we have had the author of that book on this program. He's been on our, in fact, he was one of our Conversations with Great Minds. You can find that over at conversationswithgreatminds.com, half-hour discussions. In that book, he documents how in 2004, Karl Rove organized this system where the Ohio vote was counted in Ohio, and at 11:13 p.m. at night, the entire Ohio voting system crashed. All their computers crashed. A minute later, they came up. In that minute, all the votes had been rerouted through a server system in Tennessee. And so all the vote totals flowed back into the system in Ohio, and John Kerry lost, even though the exit polls showed him winning. And not only did he lose, but he lost specifically in there was a series of counties here: Delaware, Butler, and Warren counties, and suburban Cincinnati. These counties, Bob Fitragus writes, these three counties, Delaware, Butler, and Warren, provided more than Bush's entire Ohio victory margin of 119,000 votes in 2004. So what happened in Ohio this time? Well, interestingly enough, as Fitragus notes, curiously, the Ohio Secretary of State's vote tabulation website went down at 11:13 p.m. and was mentioned by Karl Rove on the news. This is 1 minute earlier than the time on election night 2004, when Ohio calls votes were outsourced to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and then the vote flipped for Bush. Now, this is not some, you know, wild claim. Vanity Fair contributing editor Craig Unger wrote the book Boss Rove. It's right there in the book. You can read it. This time, the Cuyahoga County vote tabulation site went down as well. So when these vote tabulation sites came back up a minute later, now, back in 2004 when they came back up, all of a sudden the numbers had flipped from John Kerry winning to George W. Bush winning. But this time, when they went down, Barack Obama was winning and Sherrod Brown was winning and others. And when they came back up, Barack Obama was winning and Sherrod Brown was winning. So what was different this time, last week, from 2004? Well, this is where it gets really interesting. I mean, really interesting. Wong Kett has posted a letter that is dated 6 November 2012 by Orca Killer and the Great Oz, of Anonymous. And let me just share it with you. It's in fact, one of the things that causes me to think that this definitely is anonymous is the kind of semi-anachronistic and flowery language that they use. You know, it's like they're talking, not just wearing the masks of Guy Fawkes, but of the era of Guy Fawkes. Greetings to the good people of the Velvet Revolution. Pleased we were to see that you put your faith in the hands of we protectors of democracy. And tempted, too, to claim your generous reward, but wealth does not drive us. 2 months prior to your offer, we chose to take action against those who had subverted the will of the people in past elections, which resulted in terrible destruction across the globe. I think it's reasonable to assume they're talking about the 2004 election and the way it was stolen in Ohio electronically by Karl Rove. We began following the digital traffic of one Karl Rove, a disrespecter of the role of law, the rule of law, knowing that he claimed to be kingmaker while grifting vast wealth from barons who gladly handed him gold to anoint another king while looking the other way. After a rather short time, now keep in mind, Karl Rove put a lot of money into this voter database, this Get Out the Vote, GOTV, Get Out the Vote, program called Orca, Orca the Killer Whale. Okay, back to the letter from Anonymous. After a rather short time, we identified the digital structure of Karl's operation and even that of his orca. This was an easy task in that barn doors were left open and the wind swept us inside. So what did we do with these doors? Did we leave them open and catch the thieves as they steal the prize? Or do we close them so they cannot steal the prize? Our decision, protect the citizens. We coded and created what we call the Great Oz, a targeted, password-protected firewall that we tested and refined over the past weeks. We placed this code on more than one of the digital tunnels and their destinations that Carl's not-so-smart worker bees planned to use on election night. We noticed that these tunnels were strategically placed to allow for tunnel rats to race to the server sewers from three different states. Ah, yes, Karl tried to make it appear that there were more than three, but we quickly saw the folly of his ploy. We watched as Karl's little boys and girls confidently ran their tests while Karl told his barons to smoke cigars. So apparently what they did, what Anonymous did, if this is to be considered true, and this, I mean, you know, here's the question. I mean, Bob Petraeus, there's a lot of people scratching their head. He writes, was the fix in on Election Day in Ohio? The questions surrounding Election Day activities in Ohio and Karl Rove's now infamous meltdown on Fox TV election night are causing a buzz in the election integrity movement. Of course, we don't know for sure what happened, but we know the circumstances were eerily similar to election tampering techniques the Free Press discovered after the 2004 election. One major similarity was Rove's insistence to his colleagues on Fox News that the media consortium's exit polls were wrong in Ohio. This is the same claim he made in 2004 concerning Ohio and in 2000 concerning Florida. And then he talks about how, curiously, the Ohio Secretary of State's vote tabulation website went down at 11:13 p.m., mentioned by Rove on the news, 1 minute earlier than the time on election night 2004. When the Ohio votes were sent to Chattanooga, Tennessee, to be counted, tabulated, and sent back to Ohio. That last part, my words. Actually, his words were, and then the vote flipped for Bush. And then he adds, this isn't just a Free Press claim, but is well documented by Vanity Fair contributing editor Craig Unger in his book Boss Rove. So you go through this whole thing that Bob Petraeus wrote, and he's talking about how, you know, these experimental software patches that were supposed to be put on Ohio machines, they sued to stop that. They were unsuccessful, which kind of leaves, you know, Bob and the other people in the election integrity movement scratching their head going, what happened? How is it that Rove was able to steal Ohio in 2004 by moving the tabulations, the vote totals, out of the state at 11:13 or 11:14 p.m. over to Chattanooga, Tennessee, where they got massaged, and then they got sent back to Ohio 60 seconds later. Just in time to announce that George W. Bush had won in 2004. How is it that that did not happen this year? Well, here we have Anonymous saying, ha-ha, we found the tunnel. We found the back door, and we put a firewall in it that's password-protected, password supplied by Anonymous, not by Karl Rove. They kept the door open right up until election night. They watched Karl Rove's little rat scurrying back and forth in them, testing out the systems to steal the vote. And then they locked the fire door on election night, which makes so much sense when you consider how dumbfounded Karl Rove was that those numbers were wrong, especially in those three counties.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, November 20th, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the death toll in Gaza rises as Israeli airstrikes continue to hit the area. Peace advocates are critical of the U.S. role in the conflict and call for an end to arms transfers. President Obama wraps up a visit to Asia as advocates raise concerns about human rights in Cambodia and a broad trade pact in the region. And we'll take a look at the new leadership in China and what it could mean for the country's neighbors. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. A unilateral ceasefire took effect today in Colombia as members of the country's oldest rebel group met with government representatives. Shannon Young has details.
As part of peace talks with the government, Colombia's FARC rebels implemented a two-month-long unilateral ceasefire at midnight. The two sides are meeting behind closed doors until next Wednesday. The FARC has promised to halt all attacks on military and security forces through January 20th. Colombia's government has stated it will not consider a ceasefire until an agreement is reached. Negotiators from both sides are in Havana this week to discuss agrarian development. The issue of land is at the root of the decades-long armed conflict in Colombia and is the first item on a five-point agenda for the peace talks. It may also be one of the most difficult points on which to reach an agreement. In a press conference last month in Norway, the FARC negotiating team strongly criticized the Colombian government's economic development model with respect to land use, a model government negotiators say is not on the table for discussion. Shannon Young, FSRN.
Two of Argentina's biggest labor unions called a national strike today, demanding an increased minimum wage, higher retirement benefits, lower taxes, and more protection for workers injured on the job. Alicia Neal reports from Buenos Aires.
The streets of Buenos Aires are quiet. Banks are closed, no commercial flights are taking off, and since truck drivers are striking, no trash will be picked up, no ATMs will be refilled, and no gas or newspapers will be delivered today. Julio Macera, the press secretary for the Confederation of Argentine Workers, says he and other union members spent the morning blocking 160 freeways, streets, and bridges throughout the country.
We're asking for a minimum wage, retirement payments, and unemployment benefits that allow people to cover the basic cost of living.
Macera considers the strike a success because of widespread participation, though it remains to be seen if the government will give in to the union's demands. If the government refuses to raise minimum wage, Macera says his union will plan another action, such as a protest, in December. Alicia Neal, FSRN, Buenos Aires.
Rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo took over a strategic city in North Kivu province today and occupied the airport. The streets of the provincial capital, Goma, were quiet this afternoon as members of the Rwanda-backed M23 movement moved through the city unchallenged by either government forces or UN troops. Yesterday, widespread panic preceded a mass exodus of the city center and of surrounding camps. UN Radio's Patrick Maigwa reports.
UN aid agencies say the fighting has complicated humanitarian operations as aid workers have also been targeted. The fighting has displaced up to 60,000 people who are living at Kanyaruchinya IDP camp, some 10 kilometers from Goma. Adrian Edwards is from the UN refugee agency UNHCR.
Humanitarian activities are at this moment in many instances suspended because of the security situation. Since the beginning of the year, renewed conflict in these two regions has exacerbated an already dire humanitarian situation and uprooted close to 650,000 people.
The United Nations estimates that there are over 1.6 million internally displaced persons in eastern DR Congo as a result of fighting between the National Army and rebel groups in the region. Patrick Maigua, United Nations Radio, Geneva.
Security forces unleashed violence on residents in a Kenyan town near the Somali border for the second day in a row. At least one person is dead, nearly 50 others injured. John Bwakali reports.
The army crackdown in Garissa came after three soldiers were shot and killed by unknown gunmen yesterday. But security forces met fierce resistance from local residents. Several businesses were looted and a market burnt down. One local school official says that students were shot while in class. Mohamed Shidie, a local member of parliament, called on government to halt the military operation.
We want our people to be left in peace. We know the issues that are happening in Somalia. We are all concerned. We are not supporting Al-Shabaab. We are citizens of this country. It's like a tribal war. Any Somali is being beaten left, right and center. We are saying this must stop.
Garissa, a town bordering Somalia, has experienced several Al-Shabaab attacks in recent months. This is the first time the military has been called in, leading to the backlash from several Kenyan-Somali leaders who see the military's involvement as both unconstitutional and an undue use of force. John Bwakali, FSRN, Nairobi.
The Canadian province of Nova Scotia added gender identity and expression to the list of grounds on which citizens are legally protected from discrimination today. The move comes on International Transgender Day of Remembrance. Events and vigils are scheduled around the U.S. and around the globe. According to the Trans Murder Monitoring Project, more than 250 people were killed in the past 12 months because of their gender identity or perceived identity. Information on vigils is at transgenderdor.com. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Today, Israeli forces continue to target Gaza with airstrikes. F-16 jets shell densely populated neighborhoods, sending plumes of black smoke into the sky. An FSRN reporter on the ground in the Maghazi area of Gaza City reported ongoing shelling and frightened residents taking cover inside buildings. Palestinian Health Ministry updated the death toll today to at least 112 people, almost half of whom are civilians, and nearly 20 children. According to Haaretz, only six of those killed can be confirmed as members of militant groups. Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi indicated that Israel would end airstrikes today, according to the BBC. A Hamas official in Cairo told Reuters that hostilities would end at midnight, but a formal ceasefire has not yet been announced as we go to air. In the West Bank, Palestinians protested in solidarity with Gazans. Israeli soldiers used tear gas, chemical water, and live ammunition to counter stone-throwing youth protesting for the sixth day in a row. Two civilians were killed in those clashes so far, FSRN's Ghassan Banora reports.
Since Israel's latest military operation began in Gaza 6 days ago, Palestinians in the West Bank have responded with protests around Ramallah City, Central West Bank, Nablus and Tulkarim in the north, as well as Bethlehem and Hebron, Southern West Bank. About 100 mothers and their children held a protest today at the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem City, condemning the Israeli bombardment that has killed at least 18 children since Wednesday. Mira, who said she could not give her last name for fear of reprisal, is a mother of two.
Our children and women in Gaza are being killed. Today we march in solidarity with Gaza and to send a message that Gaza is not alone.
Two blocks away, at a different protest, Israeli soldiers attacked some 500 university and high school students who were trying to reach the Israeli separation wall, which cuts off Bethlehem from Jerusalem. Soldiers fired tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. At least 30 were injured. Muhammad, who also declined to give his name, was one of the youth protesting near the wall in Bethlehem.
The situation here is very, very dangerous. All of us here go with, on a demonstration to help other families and brothers and sisters in Gaza. All of us are Palestinian. We are one hand together.
Meanwhile, in Bethlehem, activists are planning sit-ins and prayers in solidarity with Gaza. Abdel Fattah Abasrour is one of the organizers.
With all this violent aggression against Gaza and the bombardment with Israeli missiles all over, we are here with our children to go and show our solidarity with our own people and say that we are with them. And what is happening in the West Bank is complementary to what is happening in Gaza. We refuse to be silenced and we refuse to be just simple observers on what is happening.
The area in the West Bank near the separation wall and the checkpoints has been a hotspot for clashes between local youth and invading Israeli troops. Yesterday, two men were killed by Israeli troops. 22-year-old Hamdi Falah was shot in the head by Israeli troops in Hebron City, southern West Bank. Rushdie At-Tamimi, 35, from the village of An-Nabi Saleh near Ramallah, died on Monday from wounds received at a Gaza solidarity protest on Saturday. At-Tamimi and other villagers were protesting when soldiers attacked them with tear gas and live ammunition. Later, clashes erupted between local youth and invading Israeli soldiers. A video released by activists on YouTube showed that after Israeli troops shot at Tamimi, they surrounded him and did not allow medics to treat him. Doctors say he was hit with two live rounds in his leg and abdomen. At-Tamimi died Monday from severe bleeding. Muhammad At-Tamimi is one of the nonviolent protest organizers in An-Nabi Saleh village.
There are systematic policies against the resistance in Al-Nabi Saleh, and no doubt that the Israeli attacks on Gaza gave the occupation forces new reasons to attack us and stop the protests from spreading. Today we promised our fallen hero that we will continue and we will carry on protesting all over our country.
Near the Israeli wall in Bethlehem City, as night falls, clashes continue, as is the case in many other Palestinian cities. Protesters say they are not going to stop until the attack on Gaza stops. Ghassan Balnoura, Afasaran, Bethlehem.
As more nations and international groups call for diplomacy between Israel and Gaza, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton heads to the region today, hoping to negotiate an end to the week-long violence that has claimed many civilian lives. But Amnesty International and other peace advocates are concerned that ongoing military aid to Israel and recently passed pro-Israel congressional resolutions undermine the negotiating role of the U.S. They're calling for an immediate end to all arms transfers to both Hamas and Israel, and the monitoring and investigation of war crimes committed by both sides. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Secretary Clinton broke off scheduled meetings in Cambodia today to fly to Jerusalem, where she will meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. She has also scheduled talks with Palestinian leaders in the West Bank and Egyptian officials in Cairo, but not with Hamas, which the U.S. considers a terrorist organization. Texas Republican Ted Poe agreed with this designation in a recent speech to the House of Representatives.
The terrorist group Hamas doesn't want peace with Israel. It wants war. Hamas is the aggressor here. It kills Israeli citizens and then hides behind the skirts of Palestinian women. The world should condemn Hamas, not Israel. Israel has the moral right and legal duty to defend itself from the attacks by the barbarians Hamas. The United States should be bold in its total support of Israel, our ally. The U.S. should be bold in its condemnation of Hamas. And the U.S. should be bold in this continuing war by terrorists like Hamas on civilized nations.
Poe urged Congress to pass official resolutions voicing such support. The Senate passed theirs unanimously on Friday, while the House scheduled no debate or vote and only announced Friday that the resolution passed without objection. But some representatives, including Ohio Democrat Dennis Kucinich, did object. Kucinich called the resolution unnecessarily one-sided and criticized it for not mentioning the mounting civilian deaths in Gaza. Some Jewish American advocates, including Ori Neer with Americans for Peace Now, agreed.
There is a great deal missing from such resolutions in the form of talking about striving for minimizing, curtailing as much as possible, loss of life on both sides of the border, both in Israel and in Gaza, and that surprisingly has been missing from this resolution. And the other thing, which is more important as a matter of principle, I think, is the idea of the broader picture of where we go from here in order to try to achieve peace between Israelis and Palestinians.
Both Americans for Peace Now and their Israeli sister group say the kind of support the U.S. is expressing for Israel's military actions put future peace negotiations at risk. And this goes far beyond diplomatic and political support. The U.S. government supplies Israel with more than $3 billion in military aid every year, most of which is used to buy weapons from U.S. corporations, including the F-16s and missiles currently being used over Gaza. As reporters, children, and other civilians continue to lose their lives, Sinjev Berry with Amnesty International is calling for a complete arms embargo for all the parties involved.
We are calling on individual nations to immediately suspend the transfer of weapons, ammunition, and military equipment to any of the parties in this conflict. That means specifically that the U.S. government must halt the shipments or transfer of weapons and ammunition to Israel immediately.
Amnesty is also calling for the UN Security Council to dispatch human rights monitors to Gaza and Israel to investigate and document reports of war crimes, including strikes on homes and news media buildings.
The last time there was a conflict, several years ago, of a similar nature, was total impunity in the aftermath. That meant that none of the parties, whether Israel, Hamas, or Palestinian armed groups, had any sort of internal accountability for the crimes that were committed against civilians in the conflict.
As Clinton joins diplomats from Israel, Egypt, Qatar, and Turkey to begin negotiations today, the U.S. delegation to the United Nations blocked the passage of a Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire. A U.S. spokesperson called the draft resolution counterproductive and unacceptable because it did not cite Hamas rockets into Israel as the origin of the current conflict. Alice Holstein, FSRN, Washington.
Join Free Speech Radio News on Friday, November 23rd, for a special program, Rising Tides, Rising Voices, Climate Change and the New Reality.
And those emissions are destroying the planet, and you see it in China, and you see it in El Salvador, and you see it in Peru, and now you see it in New York.
We are beginning to see some opening up in terms of disclosure about what is really going on, about how much resources are being taken, how much is being spent. So there's hope that things will begin to change.
We are all aware that time is ticking, and we are quickly running out.
Rising Tides, Rising Voices, Climate Change and the New Reality, a special half-hour program. That's Friday, November 23rd, here on FSRN. Today, leaders of Asian nations gathered in Phnom Penh, Cambodia for a final day of talks on trade, security, and territorial disputes. U.S. President Barack Obama also joined the meeting. He urged more support for a regional trade deal called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. U.S. officials traveling with Obama said Japan had expressed interest in joining talks on the deal. On Sunday, Thailand's prime minister said the country would join negotiations. But the trade deal also drew protesters in Thailand who gathered at the airport. And the extensive trade pact has drawn criticism from watchdog groups who say it could weaken environmental, labor, and consumer protection laws. Arthur Stamulis is director of the Citizens Trade Campaign. He said the deal would undercut safeguards in the Asia region.
The TPP is about setting the rules of the game for trade and investment throughout the Pacific Rim and by extension throughout the world. Unlike many countries, the U.S. agenda is not so much a national agenda as a corporate agenda. It's about handing a smorgasbord of new rights and privileges and powers to corporate interest groups.
Finding out the content of the trade deal has been a challenge, says Stamoulis, as much of the negotiations have taken place behind closed doors. But through leaked documents, the watchdog group has found that the proposed deal covers a range of issues, such as access to pharmaceuticals and labor regulations.
What we know comes from a handful of documents that Citizens Trade Campaign were the first to publish, showing that the U.S. is pushing a radical big pharma program of expanding drug patents beyond their current 20 years through the TPP, that they're expanding NAFTA's infamous investor state program throughout the Pacific Rim, which would grant individual corporations the right to challenge virtually any new law, regulation, or even court decision that negatively affects their expectation of profits and challenge them through a process that circumvents domestic judicial systems, primarily through a World Bank tribunal.
According to the documents, oil and energy companies are also pushing for easing restrictions to hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, in Asia. The Office of the U.S. Trade Representative said the agreement would make the regulatory systems of TPP countries, quote, more compatible so U.S. companies can operate more seamlessly. The next talks on the deal, according to the Trade Office, will take place in New Zealand in the first week of December. During President Obama's visit to Cambodia, human rights groups also called on the U.S. to condemn abuses under the leadership of Hun Sen, a former Khmer Rouge leader and current prime minister. According to Human Rights Watch, more than 300 people have been killed in politically motivated attacks in the country since 1991. Ahead of Obama's visit to Cambodia, the advocacy group released a report. Brad Adams is director of the Human Rights Watch's Asia Division. He's also the author of the report, and he spoke to FSRN about the record of Prime Minister Hun Sen.
He has ruled by violence, threats, and intimidation. He has carried out a bloody coup. He has been responsible for orchestrating extrajudicial executions. Cambodia has very serious problems with torture. He manipulates the courts, including in the trials of the former Khmer Rouge, where he's trying to limit the number of people who could be put on trial. And now he's engaging, through proxies, a large-scale effort to move average Cambodians off their land. So his record is deplorable, and he's kind of the forgotten strongman or dictator of the world. He's now one of the 10 longest-serving leaders in the world, and very few people pay attention to him.
When President Obama met with Prime Minister Hun Sen in Cambodia, he reportedly urged him to hold fair elections and release political prisoners. That's according to Ben Rhodes, the Deputy National Security Advisor who's traveling with Obama in the region. Are you satisfied with this action? What more could be done?
I can't tell you how upset we are with President Obama and his team. We spoke to them for months about this, as have others. They needed to not engage in business as usual. Hun Sen has got an earful about human rights for years, but nothing happens. And so we pleaded with the Obama administration for Obama to take 5 minutes out of his presidency while he's in Cambodia and give an interview or give a public talk that could be heard by Cambodians so that they could hear directly.
Well, President Obama did speak out in Myanmar, in Burma, before he came to Cambodia. He had similar calls on him to at least address human rights violations with the ethnic violence taking place in the Rakhine State, and he did come out and talk about the Rohingya people directly in that, but that wasn't the case in Cambodia.
That's right. I mean, we're very pleased with the speech he gave at Rangoon University in Burma. He addressed all the key issues. In fact, there was some debate about whether he should speak directly about the attacks on the Rohingya. And he did. And we remain mystified why he couldn't have done the same thing in Cambodia. I mean, this is a country with a leader who's been in power for 27 years, who rules ruthlessly. And one would think they would have learned from the Arab Spring that people around the world don't want to live under these kind of people anymore. And the United States should clearly be on the side of the public, not on the side of these leaders.
That's Brad Adams, director of the Asia Division at Human Rights Watch. This week, U.S. President Barack Obama also met with China's premier Wen Jiabao. Trade and political rights remain issues between the two countries. Last week, President Xi Jinping took the reins of the world's most populous country. China is currently the world's second largest economy and the global manufacturing hub for electronic goods that keeps prices low for international consumers. For 10 years, its economy grew by 400%, and so have inequality and regional unrest. Some experts estimate that as many as tens of thousands of protests spring up in China each year. Recently, China has been tussling with the U.S. and Canada over trade issues. Last year, the WTO upheld U.S. tariffs on Chinese-made tires, and the Canadian government has been reluctant to allow a Chinese state-owned energy company to take over Canadian petroleum producer Nexen. Many people are watching and waiting to see if China's new leader will uphold the status quo or challenge corruption and politics as usual. FSRN's Danny Wood spoke with Peter Kwong, a professor of Asian American Studies at Hunter College. His article, China's Shaky Leadership Transition, recently ran in The Nation magazine.
In your article in The Nation, you write that the CCP is experiencing unprecedented internal quarrels. In what ways have these quarrels changed over time?
Well, in the Chinese Communist Party, since the reform, you have developed very sharp division within the party. They're the those people who want to focus on economic growth. They're those people who felt that economic growth will sacrifice the ideological purity of the party. And then there are those who are princelings, who are sons and daughters of top leaderships. And these groups are contending among themselves. The problem right now is the Communist Party leadership has been operating in a situation that using their political power to amass personal fortune, people are very, very angry about this.
You mentioned those problems of corruption and amassing wealth, and in his speech, Xi Jinping did list corruption, taking bribes, being out of touch with the people, undue emphasis on formalities and bureaucratism as issues that must be addressed with what he described as great efforts, according to the translation aired on BBC News. What do you see as the most important issue there that he needs to address, and what can he really do about it?
I think every single party member has to talk about corruption because it's so blatant. Everybody can see it. So in order to survive, they do have to talk about it. But they've been talking about it forever. And very little has been done about it. And the reason being is Chinese Communist Party is one party system, that they are their own executive, judicial, legislative, police, and all that kind of stuff. They cannot correct themselves.
In your article, you also write that China's Communist Party is having to deal with a rising nationalism in its people, and you refer to the dispute with Japan over the islands off the Taiwanese coast, and also a mob attack on U.S. Ambassador Gary Locke's car in Beijing in September. You also say this nationalism has a potential to turn people against their leaders. Can you describe what you mean?
Yes. Recent time, Japanese government has went through a particular administrative measure that caused a great deal of unhappiness, particular anger among the Chinese public. But there were all kinds of demonstrations. And so the demonstration started out as patriotic, pure patriotic activities, slowly turning into criticism. First, criticizing that the Chinese leadership is not forceful enough. And then we see these demonstrations with Chairman Mao's portrait and slogans, and that hits at the heart of this movement. That is to say, we are not confident of the present leadership. The problem with Chinese leadership is, what do you do with this anger? And I think that's a very dangerous situation that's occurring in China today, that the government is forced to take more aggressive nationalist action to appease and divert the anger of the Chinese public.
Peter Kwong, Professor of Asian American Studies at Hunter College, New York. Thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you so much, Jim, for the opportunity to talk about these things.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Puck Lowe and Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
After their individual presentations, the speakers were asked to elaborate on their comments on what might not have been seriously addressed by the presidential candidates. Noam Chomsky spoke first.
If we ask what hasn't been seriously addressed in the past 4 years, the answer is very short, almost anything that matters. What do we do about it? What you all know. There are no magic tricks. It takes hard work, dedication, reaching out to others, trying to, in the case of the Occupy movement, which in my view is very successful and has plenty of potential, what has to be done, and the same is true of other activist movements, is to reach out to the general population. And we can talk about the 99% and say, yeah, we're concerned with your problems and your needs, but they have to believe that. And if they don't believe it, it doesn't matter if we believe it. And we're far from that. It's hard. All of the things that were mentioned, there's been an element of success in reaching out to the general population, but it's nowhere near enough. And take, say, you mentioned global warming. It's probably the most serious issue that the United States and the world faces. It's an issue that involves species survival, decent species survival, and it's not remote. I don't know. And the United States, unfortunately, is in the lead in making it worse. And the way it's discussed, the discourse about it, shows you that. So some of you may have seen, for example, the front page story in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about the ending of the summer melting of the Arctic ice. And it was a pretty alarmist story. It was an interesting one that showed what our problem is. The first half of the story, front page story, was pointing out that the Arctic ice melting was way beyond what even the most dire forecasts were of the sophisticated computer models, and talking about the dangers of this. I won't run through it, but you know them. Then the second half of the article was euphoric. It's a terrific opportunity. It opens the way to more mining, more extraction of fossil fuels. In other words, it opens up the way to accelerate the process of suicide, species suicide. Mm. And that passed, I looked for a while, it passed without comment. And that's true of the presidential debates as well. In fact, it's kind of striking that in 2008, both parties had some gesture towards global warming. The Republicans conceded that there was something going on. The Democrats had some minor programs about it. That's done. In 2012, Republicans didn't mention it. When Romney was asked, he said, well, nothing's known about it. We just need more research. The Democrats had some a few weak words, and then both candidates and both parties dedicated themselves with, fervently to what they call energy independence. There's nothing to do with energy independence, but what it means is maximizing the disasters that are going on. We have to extract all the fossil fuels we can as quickly as possible, and that's the best thing we have to do. Well, that's both parties. That's virtually the entire discussion. If you turn to domestic issues, it's the same. So if you look at popular, people have opinions, and they're very well studied. And it's interesting to look at them. So on domestic issues, the public overwhelmingly regards joblessness as the most serious issue. But the banks don't. They regard the deficit as the most serious issue. So therefore, the entire discussion is about the deficit. a couple of words on jobs here and there, meaningless ones. When you look at what people think about the deficit, it's pretty clear. Overwhelmingly, the population thinks the way to deal with the deficit is higher taxes on the rich, cutting back the military budget, which is incredibly, as you all know, it's about the same as the rest of the world combined, and making sure you preserve the benefits. You take a look at the two parties, basically the opposite. Media coverage, pretty much the opposite. And if you look more closely, it's quite striking. So there was a very interesting poll of Southern whites, you know, the red states, it's the white working class, Southern whites, on was restricted to taxes. And like the rest of the country, a large majority favor higher taxes on the rich. The same large majority favored Romney's tax plan. Now, there's only two possible explanations for this, neither of them very pretty. One of them is that our educational system and media system is so grotesque that people just don't know something of extreme importance to them. The other possibility is that the racism is so deep that if Obama suggested something, you got to be against it. And therefore, even we'll support Romney's tax plan, even if it's the opposite of what we want. I don't see any other possible explanation. All of this, repeat what I said before, I think indicates paths that have to be very seriously addressed. You cannot write off the white working class. You can't say, well, they're all Republicans, the heck with them. Those people have to be reached. You can't write off the Tea Party. If you take a look at people who call themselves Tea Party supporters, you know, get the government off our back, that kind of thing, they've been studied too. Turns out that these people think there ought to be more spending on education, more spending on health. They're wrong about how it should be done, but that's, again, our failure to educate. But more spending, more spending on help for poor people who need help, like dependent women, women with dependent children, more spending. On the other hand, less spending for welfare. Why? Because welfare has been very effectively demonized, originally by Ronald Reagan, who, you recall, he managed to instill the conception that welfare is rich black women being driven in their limousines to steal your money. So, of course, we don't want that. The same is true on international affairs. So a large majority of the public thinks the UN ought to take the lead in international affairs, and the U.S. ought to follow the will of the majority. We don't like it. It's unmentionable in polite circles, in the media or anywhere else. Actually, a majority think that the United States ought to give up the veto at the Security Council and just follow others. If you look at questions like, say, foreign aid, it's again very striking. A large majority think we have to cut back on foreign aid because we're giving away everything to the undeserving poor. The next question, what do you think foreign aid ought to be? The number that people pick is much higher than it actually is. Well, I think that shows, all of this shows there are kind of decent sentiments out there, but they've got to be organized and mobilized, and we can easily continue.
Well, to build on that, I'll make two points. The first one is that there's a really, I think, important barrier that has to be overcome. And that is the barrier that I think we have to also come to terms with, which is that to live in the United States, which was at the center of the 20th century's empire, was to benefit from that empire. And it enabled people in the so-called golden age of capitalism to have advantages on the backs of the rest of the planet. So now when people say our children will not be able to have the life that we had, you know, this apparently is a major
test of the decline of America. People say this routinely, your children will not be able to have your life. That is said actually in a way as if it's a bad thing. And in fact, from my perspective, that's not a bad thing at all. It's a good thing that it reveals that the United States, which has a fraction of the world's population and yet consumes 25% of the energy, the United States, which is unable to actually buy the amount of products that its population buys, but has to borrow from the Gulf states and China and other countries, and then provide credit cards to a population whose real wages haven't increased substantially since 1973, so that the American dream is sustained by a kind of debt-fueled consumerism, that debt purchased by countries overseas through imperial force, essentially. The power of, you know, aerial bombarding anybody around the world, the Gulf states believing that the United States is their policeman as well, etc. So they are willing to keep their super profits in dollars, they're willing to park them in the United States, therefore the banks are able to have liquidity to give out credit cards, to give out no money down payment for housing, etc. Those perquisites of imperialism are coming to an end. And it's going to be a major cultural battle to convince people that it's actually a good thing that the next generation will not live high off the hog of the planet. So that, I think, is going to be a major, major cultural and political battle to ensure that that is not seen as something bad, but something good. And how to turn that around is going to be very complicated. It speaks directly to questions of sustainability, to, you know, carbon-fueled madness, etc. It speaks directly to that. The second thing, speaking not as an activist, you know, in terms of base building, but as somebody who works mainly as an intellectual, I think it's extremely important for us to work very hard in producing a narrative, a story, a clear conception of how the political establishment in the United States is simply not serious. And again, just developing what Noam spoke about, you know, you spoke about it from the standpoint of climate change. Take the question of Iran. Every mainstream newspaper in the United States has run a story at some point in the last 2 or 3 years, often on page 6 or 7. They run these stories which say very cavalierly in the 12th or 13th paragraph, they'll say that the various intelligence agencies, and when they say various, they mean only three that are important to them, the U.S. intelligence agencies, the Israelis, and the agencies associated with the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. These three intelligence agencies are all in agreement. And this has been stories over the last 18 months at least. These agencies are all in agreement that Iran has no present desire or has no weapons program. There is no interest in weaponization. All the mainstream media have reported this. The New York Times, the Washington Post, even the Wall Street Journal ran a story where deep in the story they said none of the agencies that count, that matter to them, believe that Iran has a nuclear weapons policy. And yet, the political establishment has built this so-called case that Iran must be stopped, and you saw the Roadrunner standing there with his little sign at the UN saying that the red line cannot be crossed. Nonsense like that. They are not serious people. These are duplicitous people. They are dangerous people. And yet, the bulk of the population, including many of us, you know, many of us take him seriously. These are duplicitous people. They are not serious. They are running the planet into a very dangerous direction. You know, thank God for WikiLeaks. If you go back and look at the WikiLeaks corpus of State Department, the State Department cables, and just look at the climate change cables, at the same time as the Obama administration was so-called trumpeting a new climate change policy, breaking away from Bush, right? Obama goes in this magnificent way and arrives in Copenhagen to broker the deal. At the same time as in public they play this, you know, public relations exercise, behind the scene, State Department officials are strong-arming countries, going to Bolivia, going to Ecuador, going to Equatorial Guinea, and telling countries that you better vote against a global entente, otherwise we'll cut off your aid. And despite the fact that Evo Morales has decided quite stupidly to build a road right through a protective forest, Morales told the State Department official to get the hell out of his office. And thank God for WikiLeaks that we can read about it. And yet, we, all of us,